Welcome to New Books in Food. I'm your moderator, and my name is Valerie St. Rossi. Today, my guest is Diana Kennedy. Since the 1970s, she has been writing meticulously researched cookbooks, and there are 9 of them, which have made her the ambassador of the cuisines of Mexico to the English-speaking world. She describes herself as an ethno-gastronomer. The occasion of our conversation today is a new edition of her 1984 book, Nothing Fancy. This was republished in 2016 by the University of Texas Press. It contains family recipes from England, recipes from Mexico, and more from friends far and wide. There are also memories of food from her long and interesting life. We'll talk to her today about this book and about her wide-ranging work in Mexico on her farm, Quinta Diana. Diana Kennedy, welcome to New Books in Food.
Oh, thank you very much, Valerie. I'm delighted you're going to be talking about it. Let's see if people would be interested. As I said, it's not going to be a great big bestseller, but people, I hope my fans who are of my other books will buy it and read it and understand a little bit from where I come from.
There is there are some new things in this book that you added for the 2016 edition, and they are very wonderful additions. Would you like to talk a little about those two new chapters? One is Bête Noire, and the other is Bête Noire Écologique.
Well, yes. This is a thing that I always, I talked about this in Copenhagen at the wonderful food festival there. And I said to everybody now, they've asked me to give a presentation, and mine is not going to be very sexy, because I want us all to become aware of the waste that goes out of the kitchen. And I did say that, chef, if you invite me into your kitchen, I will not first look at your glamorous food. I will look into your garbage, because that can tell an awful lot of how people buy, whom they buy from, etc., etc. And we've all got to be more careful. You know, we cannot have more and more organic food unless we take care of our environment. And so this is the thing. So I go into, you know, the use of actually, Teflon pans aren't very good for you either. And then the use of a lot of foil should be not just thrown away, used again. It should be used very carefully, not next to the food. And we've got to think about all that plastic we're throwing away too. It is quite shocking that in this world of plenty and excess, we are polluting. And when you read, and many of you don't, because you don't read the same paper as I do, the New York Times or the Guardian, or Guardian Weekly, have articles on the ecology and what we're doing to this wonderful world in which we live. So everybody get with it. Look in your garbage, see what you could reuse, and wash. Don't tell the health inspector, of course, if you're in a restaurant. And and where you buy your stuff, and say to your purveyors, you know, you're not going to buy that little package with that white styrofoam stuff and plastic. So it's up to the public to be more demanding, I think, and to realize that things are going to cost more, you know?
Can you tell us the styrofoam scourge that we all experience in Western supermarkets, is that similar in Mexico?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And there is not enough conscience. Now, may I tell you my bête noire, sophisticated bête noire, because everybody now is doing sous vide, S-O-U-S-V-I-D-E. Now, it is ridiculous for chefs and now home cooks to to leave a machine to cook your food. Apart from that, you're sending into landfill, every time you cook something, a very solid plastic bag, having, of course, the plastics invaded your food, and then you're putting it out to landfill. Now, sous vide means you're cooking in this plastic bag, for those who don't know it, in hot water. And, of course, you can have a superbly cooked bit of fish. But what's going to happen to future generations of cooks? Of young students, culinary students, they're not going to be able to turn out beautifully cooked food if they don't have that darn machine. So that's my wind beat. And I tell you why, because they've just come out with a domestic version. So I'm going to go to a restaurant and they say something sous vide. No way. Okay. Just think about it. Think of the end product. And it's quite shocking, I think, that is coming back into vogue, and not enough people are complaining. No.
These practices in restaurant kitchens, yeah. How are chefs reacting to your critique?
Oh, I did say what I'm going to tell will send your tocs askew, your toc blanc, there's, you know, a foot high, 2 foot high. At that meeting, that particular meeting, several came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I never thought of that. And so that was the effect. We have got to be more careful of everything. But the very fact that some of the most important chefs said that to me means it's fine. Now, we've got to get food writers on board. We haven't got enough. There was something in New York Times done about I think I didn't read it myself, but on the ecology in the kitchen. But it's something that I've stressed. And I gave this as a theme many years ago when I was scholar in residence for the IACP in San Antonio. Somebody railroaded it, somebody from a university, and took off on agriculture. And I wanted to say, no, you know, that wonderful chef in Chicago, what was his name?
Charlie Trotter,
late Charlie Trotter, was the first one, I think, to be aware of this and had a green kitchen. And then Peter Kump's son, Christopher Kump, on the West Coast, was also onto this and had a solar refrigerator and things like that. So we've all got to get with it. And you look what's happening to the world. Look what's happening to space travel. Look what's happening around. Isn't it high time we got within the kitchen? You know, of course, I hate plastic stirrers. And of course, oh, these inspectors, you know, in the health inspectors want us to go plastic chopping boards. Oh my God, they're awful. They blunt your knives. They're horrible. That hold more germs, I swear, in the holes of in the little perforations in the plastic than any wooden chopping board has.
Is that
the chopping boards have been used for hundreds and hundreds of years?
Is that true, do you suppose? Because you can clean wood more efficiently than you can clean plastic?
Oh, well, I think so, yes. And the aesthetics, too, you know, that horrible white thing in the kitchen.
Yes, indeed.
And the thump with your knife, you know, your best chef's knife on it. And it's ridiculous. And to think that, you know, whatever it is, anyhow, I think we've got to get back to natural materials and not use all the stuff we use in our water. We don't need now in my house. It's totally ecological, and everything is washed with big soap, you know, just an ordinary cheap soap, and in cold water, because my helpers don't like washing up in hot water. So far, I haven't died of anything terrible, and nor have my guests. And the plastic bags I wash and hang out to dry, and I take them back to the market the next day and saying very loudly, you know, use my recycled bags. and again, you look at Oh, this one of the bete noir was, you're supposed to be baking a potato and you're wrapping it in foil and you're steaming it. You're not baking it. You haven't got that lovely, crusty, leathery skin. Now, of course, if you've got false teeth, it might prove a problem. But, you know, most of us don't have false teeth and we want that the vitamins under that skin and some different flavors and textures. You know, just think about it. Oh, another thing. Oh, my God, that kosher salt. Who on earth wants to use that? Now, you do say, read what I said about that. No, they were not my words. They were words written in a book, wonderful book called Salted. And it's Mark Bitterman. And it's a very, very good book on the different salts of the world. And what he says, and I quote him in my book, about it's okay for roadkill, but you know, everybody wants to put their hands in that kosher salt. And I don't know. And of course, the copy editors have got with it, and every magazine is using canola oil and this kosher salt. And I should think they've got shares in the factories or something. But all these things, we've got to get out of our thing. Think about it. Taste different salts. Now, of course, Mexico has wonderful sea salts from different parts of Mexico. Unfortunately, it's not generally exported to the United States. And if it would, it'd be a lot cheaper than the fabulous Maldon salt from England, or the sel from France. But look for it. And I always tell everybody who's visiting Mexico, go back with a whole bag of salt. It's only 8 pesos a kilo. But try things. Try the difference. You see, I want people to try the difference, not just follow a recipe as it. You know, get your best flavors into your food.
Well, it's clear that what you are advocating is that people think while they're in the kitchen. Don't be without awareness of your materials, your tools, your basic ingredients like salt. Could you say what it is about kosher salt? It's an industrial salt, isn't it?
Well, it's all you see what he says. He's got it scientifically. He's taken all the good elements out. And he did say it's applauding the something that isn't natural. So think about it. You know why I first went against it? Because when I was living in New York, I love corned beef and corned tongue in particular. Oh, it's marvelous. And I was doing that and it failed. And I was doing it with kosher salt and it failed. So I said, And then finally, many, many years later, I find that Mark Bitterman is telling it as it is. So think about it. Don't just get all these things just because the food magazine tells you to. Just think about it. Try things. You know?
The best cooks are the people who cook in their homes traditionally following what they learned from the grandmothers, what they learned from their aunts. And this knowledge and this kind of wisdom and common sense is hard to tap when a society becomes sophisticated. Could you talk a little about that?
Well, yes, I think it is. And people's lives have changed and they have very small kitchens and they don't want to be, if they've got a job and everybody's working in the family, you have to be practical about it. But there are some things that you could still adjust to. Now, for instance, a bread recipe. I think trying to reproduce bread is one of the most difficult things because you're dealing with lots of elements. You're dealing with the yeast. I use fresh yeast. I'd never use dried yeast. You don't know what your flour, how your flour has been treated, and the water too will make a difference. And the day, depending how moist the atmosphere is. So I think that's one of the most difficult things to do. You'll make some bread and it'll be perfectly edible, but you won't be able to reproduce exactly what a baguette that you had in Paris, or certainly the croissant you had in Paris. Oh dear, where are the good croissant makers? They all are making flaky pastry things. Because I'm a cook. Let's face it. I cook everything. Everything in my kitchen, the vinegars, the jams, the marmalades, everything is cooked from scratch. Now, and I suppose partly because I can't buy it, but partly because I prefer to use the several oranges on my land, for instance. They're great at the moment. I've just done 14 pounds of several orange marmalade.
Oh, lovely.
No. Breakfast is not breakfast in England if you don't have several orange marmalade. So that's sitting with its labels on, and unfortunately friends of mine love it so much, so I have to make several batches while the oranges are in their prime, and they're picked from the tree and immediately made into the marmalade, and or a drink too, into a fruit drink with very little brown sugar in it, very little, and that's the most healthy fruit drink you can have. It was very interesting. There was a wonderful old lady in Sitakura, which doesn't exist anymore. And I took her some of my my marmalade, actually, of several oranges. And she threw up her hands in so happy. And she said, oh, paralabilis means very good for the gallbladder. So isn't that interesting? Because the several orange, apparently, and its derivatives are good for the gallbladder. So, there we go. It's all sorts of interesting things happen in my life. And as I say, the thing is to cook all the time, everything.
It's really the only teacher there is.
Yes.
And going back to what you said in the beginning about cooking is about making mistakes.
Oh, yes.
And learning from them. But since you were speaking about bread baking, I noted something in one of your introductory recipes to yeast breads that I wanted to ask you. You mentioned warming a flour before you make bread. Now, I've never heard that before.
I think even Julia does that. Never use your bread cold out of the refrigerator. All right? You want it to be dry and slightly warm, and that'll help the yeast along. Now, a tip.
That seems logical.
Yeah, but there's a tip. If you've got, always keep in your refrigerator in the lower drawer, about 2 pounds of flour, have it cold. Now, if you have a severe burn, the best thing you can do is to put that cold flour on the burn. So I always have a 2 pound bag of flour in the lower part of my fridge and tell my helpers, here it is now, don't forget. There's aloe vera outside to help the curing stage, but when you burn, slap on all this cold flour. So there's one you... Cold flour. It's one used for cold flour, but not for bread. Okay.
I see. So it's the burn bag of flour.
Exactly. Yes.
Excellent.
And so somebody's forgotten and put it into the normal flour. But I must say that when I see people doing a pie crust or something in the cuisine art, I mean, I love a cuisine art. It's got great things, but not for that. You've got to feel the texture. And nobody will leave. Everybody laughs about English food, of course. But, we had the most varied menus. We had no money. Not poor, but, my mother had to be careful. And she was very much a follower of the old cookbooks. But we were brought up making four kinds of pastry. I mean, there was short crust, there was demi-frite, there was frite, there was choux pastry, and then there was a hot water pastry with that lovely, greasy, marvelous pastry for the English pork pies. Nobody makes a pork pie in England. I mean, they're more sophisticated in France, but the English pork pies with that wonderful crusty pastry made with lard. Now, lard, make your own lard, for goodness sake. You don't want all that white stuff you get in the supermarket. And so, you know, it's okay, it's time consuming, but you make a batch and you keep it, and it keeps for 2 years. And you've got it there ready. You see, I think the great thing about having a successful kitchen is you've got things already made and stored. And some things will store, some things don't store.
And that's what you describe in your book. You do say how to make lard, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's there in both versions, yeah. The original and the new one.
And you try, and oh my God, people say, oh, were these refried beans done with lard? Well, if they're not, I'm not going to eat them. You know, you're only absorbing a little bit. If it's a religious thing, okay, well, you get away with it. But, I mean, forget it. Let's get this cholesterol thing straight. The latest thing on women's cholesterol, and women with high cholesterol live longer. Now, that came out last year, and everybody, that shook the medical, you know, the medical establishment, the roots, and everybody, because I eat lard, you know. I mean, my tomatoes are made with lard, my food, but you don't eat that much, you know. And always in my pastry, my pie crust pastry was my mother's recipe. Okay, so it's a pound of flour and it's half a pound of fat. No more. It's not a glamorous thing. It's just a pie pastry, but it's delicious. But with a good butter, I put 2 tablespoons of lard, and it just gives it that little finish of texture that is so good.
So it's the texture of lard that cannot be reproduced.
Yeah, because it's much, it gives a much somehow short thing to the pastry, you know. Mm-hmm. And butter matters too. Oh my goodness! Somebody gave me 2 kilos of butter from Querétaro in the central Mexico from a cheesemaker who makes butter, mm-hmm. And I want you to know the texture of that pastry, because I always have pastry ready in the fridge for making a quiche or whatever, and the texture of that pastry with that butter, I mean, this natural butter, and of course a touch of lard, was so sensational that I sort of held it in my taste memory forever.
My goodness. I have a question to ask you. Since we're talking about pastry, you mentioned that one should always use a metal spoon for pastry. I have never heard that before. Why?
Well, because it's cold. Now, I have to laugh in your chat. When the school I went to, I got a scholarship to a very fancy school. I couldn't have gone otherwise. And they had cooking classes. And I nearly failed one of my cooking tests because I was caught using a wooden spoon for my pastry. Now, when you are doing your good pie, let's take pie crust, okay? You want everything cold. You want your water cold. You want your bowl cold. And then you don't want to put in a wooden spoon. You've got to put in a metal spoon. It'll be cold.
I see.
But I remember that from my childhood. I'd never forget that. I mean, a silly way to lose points on your cooking test, right?
And these are the things that you learn from home cooks.
Yes.
You were lucky enough to be taught it in school, but generally someone learned that going back much further.
From my mother, too. She always used to use metal spoon, but I never thought about it in a cooking test, you know, at school. See, I learned a lot from my mother because, as I said, she taught school, but everything, and especially if you read the chapter on Christmas, you know, from a very, very early age, we were all called in to help sort the dried fruit. And let's face it, we had raisins, white raisins, you call it. We called it sultanas and currants. And then we had muscat raisins. And so we had to take the seeds out of the muscats, and we had to prepare all this fruit and cut up the candied peel. And so very early age, we had our hands in the food, right?
It is about touching, isn't it? And your hands become full of wisdom. And this is probably what doesn't exist in modern kitchens and with lots of equipment, things so you don't get dirty, the idea of not getting dirty.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from. Do you?
It's so silly, isn't it? It's so silly.
I would like to ask you about Mexican food for a moment. There could be a million questions, but I have one, which is, when you first began your research and writing about Mexican food for English-speaking readers, what were the misconceptions about Mexican food that people possessed?
Well, first of all, it's all hot. And also, generally, the use of chilies in the U.S. is the chefs put too much picante. And you realize that every chili has a flavor. So you use it in different ways. And that, by the way, I wish everybody who started Mexican cooking would buy my book, My Mexican Kitchen, Techniques and Ingredients, because there it clarifies the chilies, because some of the chefs in cooking get it all wrong. They get the morita instead of chipotle mora. And that also gives some of the aromatic herbs that are used. A lot of aromatic herbs are used in Mexican in food, depending on which area of Mexico you are. And of course, pumpkin seeds are used, and the delicious pipián, not a mole, but a pipián, the base of the sauce in itself, would be toasted and ground pumpkin seeds. And it's absolutely delicious. So all these things, it's very exciting to me to have traveled as I have traveled. The Oaxaca book took 14 years of research and writing and cooking. And it is, nobody's done it. And now somebody is plagiarizing it, that awful Fiden book, Mexico the Cookbook.
Oh, she's really?
Yeah, she's got 14 of my recipes. Now, it's not fair. You see, I know there's all this polemic about where recipes belong, but nobody has done the research. Nobody sat in one recipe she's got of mine, and they actually used it, Fiden used it in their publicity. It was so silly.
Oh, my.
Was when I had traveled for 8 hours over the mountains and sitting in a kitchen that they allowed me to sit in and watch them make a certain type of bean tamale. So it takes hours, I was there for hours while everything was done. And of course, the son-in-law comes in and he says, by the way, I've brought you a try of the barbacoa of res, of beef, that I make every weekend and sell in the market. And he gave me that recipe. And she's got me that recipe. And nobody in Fiden, on that 600 recipes, there's not one credit given. So it's infuriating, because these recipes have never been, many of them have absolutely never, ever been published. I did the original research. I used all the money I had on these trips in those 14 years and to find it. And of course, the editors in Fiden are to be blamed, because they have not found out where the recipes come from. And I gather they do what they call a Bible of every country's food. And some of them, I'm told, are pretty awful of the other kinds. But anyhow, I have to say this, because it is so annoying to me to have, we made these wonderful trips. Nobody knows the wonderful education I've had driving myself in my truck with my sleeping bag and my cot, because I never know where I was going to sleep, up in the mountains, and learning from these women. And they were so generous and willing to share, because they were so interested that somebody wanted to know how they dealt with their ingredients, how at what point the masa was right for the tamales, and all this sort of thing. So it's been years of hard work, immensely hard work, but enormously satisfying.
I'm sure that wherever you go, what you learn is the people have mastered every ingredient that's local, and they are the experts on the use and the variety of uses.
Right. Which, of course, some of the younger chefs have never done. So there are some misalliances of the food. Now, they think I'm terribly critical, but I say, you know, go back and learn your basic things.
Did you find it unusual to create a cookbook, nothing fancy, which wasn't strictly about Mexican food?
Well, it was my editor. You know, I have had the most wonderful editor, Frances McCulloch, from Cuisines Mexico, and now she helped me with sorting out the new Nothing Fancy. And she is the greatest researcher I've ever known. She knows what's around you. It's fabulous. And she told me to write it. She said, I know you've got these recipes from your family. And from friends, and I've tried all sorts of exotic things in your house. Please write. So she prompted him to write. Now, nobody ever, all the bakers on board, do your own hot cross buns. That's the most fabulous recipe you'll ever come across. And the hot cross buns in the US are awful, and many of them in England are, but you do your own. Okay, you've got three risings, you've got all sorts of dinner things to do that's going to drive you mad, but do it. Because, oh, God, the flow. I'm just waiting. My oven gave up the ghost, and I've got a new oven. And so I'm just waiting. I can't wait to do my hot cross buns and have them with tea in the afternoon.
That sounds absolutely divine. I think I might want to be there when they come out of the oven.
Yes. After they keep. You know, a good... well-made dough of any, especially of that type, slightly sweetened, improves in flavor, and always can be revived in a hot oven, or dip it very quickly in milk in a hot oven. So you don't always have to have it straight out of the oven, but it is divine because of the smell, with all the spices, and then citron peel. I use in those. Now, citron peel, I have citrons in my orchard, which
really?
Is what brought it. Yes, yeah. And so I make my own citron peel and angelica. I've got some angelica because all these flavors people are forgetting. And just add these actual touches that I remember from my childhood.
It's absolutely true, isn't it? And I think that the function of candied fruits,
yeah,
always worked in worked as an element of sweetness, mm-hmm. when sugar was expensive.
Yeah, and texture too. They're nice bite through it when you're going into that doughy mass, and then you've got a little texture of a good raisin. So I quite agree. It's it all adds to the spice of life in cooking, you know. You don't want to simplify some things. And there are these subtle flavors that you want to preserve. And I do it. I cook the stuff that my mother did. Not all the stuff. And let's face it, I hated her rabbit stew, but it was the cheapest thing in the market. And nevertheless, some of the things, especially the doughy things, and as I say, her pie crust and all her desserts. And you've got to, if you like gingerbread, now do try that sticky gingerbread in my recipe. It came from a friend years and years ago when I was living in Scotland, and it sinks in the middle. Don't worry, it's gooey, it's fabulous, absolutely fabulous. But use the Tate and Lyle's golden syrup first, and then their treacle, because that will give it the right texture rather than the thinner syrups that you have.
I read somewhere that gingerbreads always sink in the middle.
Oh, really? And that's interesting. Well, I've seen a lot that don't, because people put enough, pumping up baking powder into it. But this is so damp and sticky and gooey that, oh, my God, it's just divine. Yeah. And that'll keep, of course.
I believe that you have cooking courses at your farm. Is that correct?
Well, it's hardly a farm. I call it a quinta because it's mostly fruit and vegetables. Yeah, I have bees, I have chickens, all organic eggs, everything like that. I have been doing boot camp At one first, I used to do it with Marilyn Townsend, and then I'd do it on my own. Now, for some financial reasons, it all got screwed up last time. Yes, and it's fun. 8 people come, and they stay at the lovely, lovely little hotel near me, and they come, and we work for 6 hours, and everybody works. And go right through. We make the moles, but we make chorizos and tamales and all sorts of things. It's terribly hard work, but it's wonderful to see people learning the processes, the technical things, and the techniques that bring out flavor. Now, to my mind, there's a basic thing that people don't do, and that is pay attention to the way that you are preparing your basic ingredients. That's going to take all the difference in the world. But in Mexico, you have to toast the chilies sometimes, you have to soak them, you have to toast the seeds or something, to, and you have to asar or char your tomatoes, cook them, and that makes all the difference to the flavor of food. And what interests me is the difference between great flavors. And not them people, some people maybe have too many drinks and then go through a meal and don't notice. No, I will criticize things, but I also, if there's something great on a menu, I will send a message back to the kitchen because they don't know if anybody is noticing the subtleties of their good food.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you say about how different a tomato can taste. I think we just slice them and eat them by and large in the West, isn't that?
Well, I think it's pretty awful if you're going to use those romas. They're horrible. I've never had a salad with romas. You wait till the heirlooms come here. If you've got a garden, for goodness sake, plant them, because there's nothing like a great tomato. In Mexico, they're all using these plump tomatoes, and they call them saladets, and it's absolutely appalling. Now, unfortunately, my crop was ruined by early rains last year, but what I do when I get a crop is to weigh batches. And then asar them. They say asar, putting on a comal until they're mushy and slightly charred. And then I freeze them ready for the next year. This year, they're just about to come in my first tomatoes. And so we haven't had any rain. We're in a drought, which is very sad, but it's very good for the tomatoes. And it's very bad for the corn. So you can't get anybody who doesn't believe in climate change or to just go and hide themselves away, put themselves into they probably live in air-conditioned rooms. Climate change is affecting everything. Everything.
Can you describe what kind of climatic adjustments, and I mean in with respect to food, that you had to make when you moved to Mexico from the very different climate of Europe and England in particular?
And I was in Canada, of course, before I went to Mexico. I think you learn what the local people do. If there's a good cooks in your area, you try and cook with them and you learn from them. Now, the only thing you have to learn here, well, for in Mexico City, where I first lived, because my husband was, as you know, journalist, New York Times, was to adjust cooking times at high altitude. Things will take much longer to cook because the boiling point is much lower. So you have to take care. I did find, too, that the amount of sugar was slightly adjusted, but I followed a recipe the first time. I mean, the second time, then I'd learned, you know. And, of course, beans. You want your beans. You know, the greatest thing for cooking your beans, if you're not in Mexico, is a crock pot. You'll never burn your beans, and they'll have that wonderful wafting smell all night through your house. And so I do recommend the crock pot for beans.
Isn't that wonderful? Anything else that we should know? How about epazote?
Well, that's very much an acquired taste, but you have to use it. In black beans, you have to use it. There's certain things you have to use to get used to it. And it's a pungent, wonderful flavor that is so Mexican. Now, I say so Mexican, it's not used and liked in the north of Mexico. It's used more as a tea and to as a vermifuge, and for gas. In the southern part of Mexico, more so. Now, obviously there are exceptions, but it is used, as I say, in black beans, not in other beans, generally speaking. And then in a real quesadilla, which is a raw a tortilla, and a bit of cheese, a strip of chili poblano, and a few leaves of epazote. That was the way I first learned to eat a quesadilla, cooked, not fried, and cooked on a comal, a raw masa with those things in it. And that was the most distinctive flavor. And also, it's used to have a plant, doesn't like a lot of water. And then, if you have ants in the house, you crush it and throw it down. And a tea, as I say, if you're sort of gassy after your beans, make a tisane out of it. And there it is. Use it fresh. But it's wonderful herb. Oh, my God. Anybody who doesn't like it needn't come to dinner.
I do see it in dried packets. Is it all right to use
dried? No. Dried isn't the same. If you're going to do a tea, it's okay. But not for using. No, you need it fresh. You really do need it fresh.
As you were describing the difference between using this herb in the south and in the north of Mexico, it made me think about how culturally southern style of cuisines and northern style of cuisines has always had this little, oh, we don't eat that, they eat that down south. Like in Europe, garlic is considered southern Europe and not northern Europe.
Right.
When I think of cooking in America, you know, lots of fried things is considered more southern style cooking. And in the north, it's not at all the same. And it's what's interesting in your description is that this also pertains in Mexico. And there are quite the same kind of, we don't do that, we do this.
Right.
They do that, we don't do it. Are there other ingredients that are markedly limited in their use in the north or south?
Yes, the huitlacoche, the fungus on the corn. Mm-hmm. Some areas, very few areas, don't use it. Mm-hmm. And then in only one area in Mexico, two remote areas, they use it dried. It dries on the plant. And then when they put it into, it's in my book. Which book is it in? Oh, I don't know which book it's in. I think it's My Mexico. An Odyssey of Culinaria. That same woman is following my chefs around, my cooks around in a TV program. Oh, no. That book is so full of fascinating things. You should buy it. You really should buy it. It's very interesting that in one place in Tlaxcala, the state of Tlaxcala, and I believe, but I haven't been up there, in part of Nayarit, they use this dried huitlacoche. It makes a powder and it goes in with dark chilies and it's like a rather light mole because it doesn't have almonds and raisins and all the stuff in. And it's just a haunting flavor. It's just wonderful.
And is it possible to get that outside of Mexico?
No, I doubt it. I think the border people would have a fit if it just came, and they'd probably think it's some sort of colored marijuana or something, you know. Who knows, you know. So there are some things. And, of course, the different types of chilies that there are in Mexico, which is so fascinating. Again, I talk about them in Ingredients and Techniques. It's a very, very important book. Not enough people are buying it.
This is The Mexican Kitchen, My Mexican Kitchen?
My Mexican Kitchen, right, right. Because it does clarify the techniques, certain techniques. And I just think that you can get an awful lot from it anyway. Learning about the aromatic herbs, I think this is very, very important. Now, for instance, there's one thing. In my pantry, I have 9 types of what they call oregano. Now, 9 types. And there are more, because everywhere you go, there's the same type of plant. No, not always. There's an exception to this, but it's a type of plant that grows in a different way in different climates and different things. So that is collected and used as oregano and not the general oregano that you use. And it's used always dried, not fresh.
Interesting. Now, there's something that you mentioned in Nothing Fancy that I found surprising because I was so ignorant of it. You said that in Mexico, salsa is not a sauce, it's a condiment. So we've got it all wrong.
No, it's the word salsa is misused. When you say salsa, you do mean like a salsa in a container on the table and used as a condiment, okay? Mm-hmm. You may open your quesadilla and put some salsa in it. But when you're talking about a whole dish, like a mole, for instance, that's not a salsa, okay? And there are many, many dishes like that wherever you go using local chilies. And that one being called a salsa. The salsa is, as I say, a separate use of chilies or tomatoes or lo que sea on the table, and you use to cook. If you have a tostada, maybe you want a bit more salsa on it. But that's the use of the word. But the word is very, very loosely and badly used, usually.
I see what you mean. We are not well informed in so many of the aspects of Mexican cooking. I'm very curious to know. I know that your books are translated into Spanish,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to know what other translations have been made.
I don't know. There was a funny little thing of the Tortilla book in Dutch, of all things, that died out. No, and I think there is a reason. There was going to be something in German, but I think when the translators come across all these plants that people can't buy, I think that comes to a dead halt. Now, maybe maybe I'm mistaken, maybe there are, but it's a very, very difficult thing to translate something relying on these local ingredients that they can't use. They don't know what it smells or tastes like. So I think that there is a problem there.
I suppose the fact that the United States and Mexico has a border that's 1,989 miles long makes us the best audience for Mexican food.
Yes, but I say this. When I go into the local markets, especially where there's a heavy Mexican population, as some of the chilies are mislabeled, the range of ingredients is not that great because they're catering to where those immigrants came from. So that matters a lot. I remember this absolutely huge one in St. Louis, Missouri. Huge, huge market. But it was rather disappointing because it depends. Now, one of the best is the La Fiesta market in Fiesta, it's called. Not La Fiesta, it's Fiesta market in Austin. Now, they used to have one in not in Dallas or Fort Worth, I can't remember. And they used to have one in San Antonio, and it no longer exists. I mean, I could cry because they brought in, in February there would be the Naranja Agria. They had, then they had special wrappings, not corn husks, for certain tamales. And it really was, and still is, the one in Austin still is, about the best. Now, not only that, of course, but they have aisles like Great Britain, and you can buy all the wonderful teas and the stuff, and India and things like that. But their Mexican section generally is much more wide than any other supermarket.
Well, I would like to ask you now about two things. First, your collection, your notes, and your studies in botany are being collected. I believe they're being digitized. Is it by the National Autonomous University of Mexico?
No. It is something called CONABIO, and it's the National Commission for the Studying the Use and Conservation of the Biodiversity of Mexico. Now, Mexico has gone from eight in up to four, the fourth country with the biggest biodiversity in the world. And they, an ex-governor one of the university, a wonderful man, Jose Sorocan, with another scientist, started this many years ago. Well, I don't know, probably about 20 years ago. And it is, the government, I think, gave them some money for it. And they decided that what I have done in my books and the markets I've studied and photographed were of value. So they digitalized my slides. Now, of course, I'm on, got a digital camera, but I didn't have those hundreds of slides. Then scanned the notes from my travel books and took certain recipes from my books that actually clarified the use of a certain plant. Now, it's a great, great honor. And I am delighted, and they actually gave me my own website. So there's a página web, as they call it, Diana Kennedy, within CONABIO.
Really?
Yes. And now, unfortunately, it's not in English. I'm hoping that they could come up with some thing to put it in English, because it has to be in English. It's in Spanish at the moment. So it's a very great honor. Now, there are a lot of things, say, on my computer. I have about 1,500 other photos that haven't been yet downloaded and put into their stuff. It is very exciting to me to know that what I did, for purely interest, because I've never made money, never had money, I did as purely interest and excitement and adventure, has been of use. Now, that to me is the greatest thing. And so there it is, a lot of my stuff, not all, but a lot. At the moment, too, I'm trying to find a repository for my papers and things when I die. I'm 94, and I hope I can make it to 100. I'm trying to get there. I've got a driving license to 100, so I better use it. All my papers and stuff, my library. Radcliffe seemed to be very iffy about it. That's where it should go because of the greatest collection of culinary writings of people in the U.S. And, of course, I started off in the U.S. Doing my stuff, my culinary, Mexican culinary stuff. But at the moment I'm working on it because it has to be there for other people who are not fortunate enough to have seen Mexico. I've seen it. I have driven from Chihuahua down to Yucatan, not once, hundreds of times, alone, stopping, picking plants, asking, taking photos in markets and things like that. So it should in some way be, you know, saved. Because things are changing, tastes are changing, chilies are tasting. You know, they're bringing in chilies guajillos, which is shocking, shocking that people in Mexico are doing this, bringing in chilies, dicen guajillos from China. Then they're smaller, they're
is
not
that
as
so?
Yes, China and even Peru. And they're not the same, and they haven't got the same pungent flavor as those from Zacatecas, where there are several types of that chili. So I'm always fighting, but unfortunately, nobody else has taken it up seriously enough. But that's true, because, you know, it's an awful bore for people to hear these old ladies saying, oh, my God, it's not as it used to be. But it isn't. I mean, the flavors aren't the same. And I know it's a bore, and one shouldn't do it too often, but I have to when I have a public platform like yours, thank you very much, to say these things, things that do preoccupy. Another thing that does really are all the new seeds. Now, the new seeds, I was told by somebody coming mostly out of Holland, providing they are producing fruits and vegetables that are larger, shinier, more colorful. But where's the flavor? There's no flavor. So we've got to preserve our authentic stuff, the wild stuff, the stuff that is around in the remote corners that people have, you know, a little bit of land where there's an apple tree that's been there for, well, after the Spaniards came, I suppose. But still, we have to preserve all these things and try things and eat things. Be critical, but stop and think what you're eating. Don't just gollop things down, you know.
Well, thinking is key, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Thinking and training and discussing things and criticizing but constructive criticism. You know, I can't criticize a dish unless I can tell them where they went wrong or where they did not do everything. And yes, I'm sorry, everybody, but you know, I've been 60 years cooking here, and I cook every day, and my kitchen is a living place. I mean, my old artis, my fruit paste, my vinegars, my breads, everything's made here. And it's very tiring, I might tell you sometimes, but nevertheless, it's an education to how you use things in a different way and how you preserve flavor. So
I know that you are the author of many books, but I think it's time for another book. Is there another book in the pipeline?
No. I will help some states do their own cookbooks, which have been either appallingly done or not done at all, because I took now from Oaxaca al Gusto, which is a major work. Nobody's done it. Everybody knows Oaxaca. Oh, they go to Oaxaca. They know the food in Oaxaca, the Valley of Oaxaca. But they don't even realize that Oaxaca is in 11 different parts, at least. There are others, but I've divided that book into 11, because in each of those regions, there are specialties. There's a separate chili. There are separate ingredients used. And so it is my pride and joy, Oaxaca al Gusto, especially the English version, which Texas Press have published, are still publishing. The Spanish version I didn't have strict control of some of the photos, so I did change them, some of them, for the English version. But it is anybody who thinks they know Oaxaca, I'm just Oaxaca, go and look at this book. Because as I said, 14 years and trying to get to the research and come back and cook, but also persuade publishers to publish it in its entirety and not try and cut it up or, you know.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, exactly. So I don't think so. Cookbook, I don't think so. I will help other states do it because, I was going to say, Oaxaca I based on what I consider the only great book of a state, a state in Mexico, and it was on Veracruz, because people who did that book knew what they were doing. Now, there are other books done in other states, but it's all by fancy people who, you know, wanted to jazz it up. But I based it on that because that was divided into the different areas of Veracruz. There are many, many different geographical areas. And so I based my book, Oaxaca, on that. And now it turned out to be 11 areas. So it's a heavy book, but didn't need more of them. I mean, it's something to be had and treasured and looked at and digested, because here are these wonderful things that are being preserved by people way up in the mountains in probably more isolated places. And it's very exciting. And even when I look through it myself, I get excited because I remember all those trips I made.
What is the Oaxaca book? It's Oaxaca Augusto, correct?
Yeah, right.
And it's available from University of Texas Press, mm-hmm. just as the new edition of Nothing Fancy, which is just not even a year old. Also from University of Texas Press. I would like
to... My Mexico. They've also got My Mexico.
I see. I would like to invite you to speak to us for the next 5 hours. But I know that you have things to do in the kitchen, I imagine. I wonder if you would give us a closing salvo, because it has been a delight to provide you with a platform, and you will always have a platform here, I assure you. So could you give us a thought to take away?
Well, I mean, I have to say, buy my books and study them. And when you go to the supermarket, take it with you and make sure you're buying the right thing. Because unfortunately, what's happening, go back to that chili guajillo, what's happening is they're importing from Mexico and it's wrongly labeled. So nobody in future, I talk to a lot of culinary students, I tell them this, you've got to go back, get the real ones from Zacatecas, make a sauce, learn what those flavors are before you use the others, right? So, but that's getting a little esoteric. You know, I am going into it, I think, probably far more deeply than people would like. And there are some of them who are absolutely irritated by my English accent. I'm sorry, I apologize. I mean, my thing is, learn more about it. And when you travel to Mexico, go to the markets and learn and ask how, depending on how your Spanish is, but try all the local flavors of that area, because remember, they're all different.
And it sounds to me like one of your suggestions is also to become a little better at Spanish.
Well, yes. Yeah, that certainly helps, so that you can talk. But they're very kind. You know, they're not like the French. If you go to Paris and try to speak, then they can be very snooty. But they're very kind. If you try and see and talk slowly, they respond very beautifully. They're very kind.
They sound like the best neighbors, don't they?
Yes, I know. And this U.S. with this 2,000 mile border is going to suffer. Now we know politically, and it's so sad.
We will use your books to volley over whatever does or does not come to pass. I want to say once again that the new edition of Nothing Fancy was issued in 2016 by the University of Texas Press. Its author, Diana Kennedy, has honored us with so many thoughts and descriptions of her activities and her pursuit of truly the authentic and the genuine in the cuisines of Mexico. I want to thank you so much for being our guest, and please come back again with a new book. We would love to speak to you.
Oh, Valerie, thank you so much for giving me all this time to expound on the things that I'm passionate about. But I did want to say that it was chosen by the Los Angeles Times as the Book of the Week a few months ago.
So congratulations on that, and we shall all run out and get our copy. So for New Books in Food, I want to say once again, thank you so much, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.